This is Hazel Kahn with my guest, Abigail Abarbanel, who is a psychotherapist in private practice in Scotland. She's been in private practice since 1999, and she's a very vigorous political activist. She's born and raised in Israel. Abigail, it's a pleasure to be on another Skype call with you, which continues actually our several years long conversations. We first started when you were in Australia, now you're in Scotland, and these were all tidings programs on WPKN Radio. So welcome to you.
Thank you for having me, Hazel, again.
Yeah, I hope it won't be the last time. As long as they keep doing terrible things out there in the Middle East, we'll be at it. Abigail, this time, though, you've written an important article, which was published in August by Mondo Weiss, in which you say that in order to liberate the Palestinian people from Israeli occupation, BDS, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement that was initiated at Palestinian request, that's not enough. We must also liberate our language. You say we need to get rid of euphemisms and false language and call what Israel does by its real name. So why don't you take it from here and tell our listeners what you mean by that?
What I mean to say is that for a long time I've been hearing in the media and reading articles and political analysis from different people, opinions and even really important statements about Israel and Palestine that are pro-Palestinian, that can be critical of Israel, but are still using a very limited language. And by limited language, I mean that they use words like peace process. They use words like occupation. And I find these words and phrases to be very problematic. Words like occupation don't capture the real reality of Israel and Palestine, and neither do the words peace or peace process, or even the word conflict bothers me a great deal. Mm-hmm. My argument is that those words are actually there to obscure and confuse the real reality of the situation. And what, in my opinion, is behind it is Israel's own propaganda or Hasbara campaign, which is really trying to lure us away from, as I call it in the article, the scene of the crime, to just put us on a false path that is much more comfortable for Israel. And it delays or distracts people from facing the real reality of what's going on the ground. As long as Israel talks about or promises that there will be peace talks, as long as we talk about a conflict, it's as if we're talking about two equal people. As long as we're talking about an occupation, we're talking about something that sounds impermanent, something that sounds temporary, and it serves Israel very, very well. In my article, I argued that we need to call what's going on in Palestine and Israel exactly for what it is, which is that Israel is really a result of a settler colonial project. And settler colonialism, if you look at the scholarship on it, for example, there's this fellow called Wolf who writes a lot about settler colonialism and colonialism. It's about the policy of elimination. And everything that you see Israel do, and everything that Israel has always done, shows that Israel has been incredibly consistent.
Patrick Wolf, I think, is who you're talking about,
Patrick,
right?
Wolf, that's right. W-O-L-F-E. Yeah. Highly recommended.
I have taken from the quote that you have in your article from Patrick Wolf. The article is called Settler Colonialism and the Elimination of the Native. Mm-hmm. Whatever settlers may say, he says, and they generally have a lot to say, the primary motive for elimination is not race or religion, ethnicity, grade of civilization, etc., but access to territory. Territoriality is settler colonialism's specific, irreducible element. Settler colonialism destroys to replace. As Theodor Herzl, founding father of Zionism, observed in his allegorical manifesto/novel, if I wish to substitute a new building for an old one, I must demolish before I construct. And that's what's going on. Though, in a way, it's not quite accurate, because a lot of what Israel is doing is not actually demolishing. It does a lot of that, too. But it's constructing on some virgin territory that was never built on before. I think people don't understand what a settlement is. It's not the lonely, single trailer on top of a hill. Describe what these settlements are and why it's really about territory.
First of all, Hazel, I don't call the settlement settlements. That's another one of those language traps. Settlements are actually colonies, And secondly, they are not built on virgin land. They're built on Palestinian land, on farmland, in areas where there have been Palestinian dwellings and villages and towns. Israel has started this policy from its beginnings, from 1947 onward, but the Zionist movement started it from the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. There were people living in Palestine all over the land. And Israel has demolished, and Israel is uprooting olive trees, invading Palestinian farmlands all the time, and simply just confiscating it, just taking it. I just don't agree that it's virgin land. I don't think it ever was. I think it's one of those myths, you know, a land without a people for a people without a land, or making the desert bloom, or terra nullius, you know that term?
Yeah, I was actually just going to mention that. I just want to say that terra nullius is, it's not unique to Israel. Israel is actually enacting what is a universal way of being a settler colonialist.
Yeah. Declaring the land is empty. We don't recognize the native or the indigenous people to be real people, entities that have any rights of their own. We don't recognize their achievements or the way that they live as something that we value or recognize as civilization. And therefore, we declare it as empty and we take it and we do whatever we want with it. Mm-hmm. What I find incredibly difficult to digest is the hypocrisy in a world that is supposed to be post-colonial. We keep trying to make peace with our past, with indigenous people, welcoming indigenous people to previously colonist societies that treated their people very badly, but are now recognizing that and somehow owning up. They're doing things to try and make some amends for their past sins. And in a world like that, a post-colonial world, Israel is still allowed to continue with its settler colonial project uninterrupted and with impunity. And the reason it's allowed to get away with it is because of the specialness business, because through the use of language, amongst other things, people are convinced, are being taught that it's a special case. Israel is trying to move us as further away as possible from the term settler colonialism. And people like Ilan Pape have brought it to the foreground, to the center of our discussion. And I think it's time that we really emphasize that. In my article, trying to encourage all activists everywhere who are trying to support the Palestinian people to actually watch their language so they don't end up playing into the paradigm that Israel wants us to be a part of.
We need to say a bit more about what settler colonialism is.
Settler colonialism is quite simple. Ilan Pappa says that basically settler colonialism follows empires, if you like. So traditionally a colonial power would conquer some land somewhere or invade it. And then people from that culture would come in and would settle lands within that conquered territory. Basically, the idea is to replace the indigenous people with the people that come in, the settler colonizers culture. Israel was created not because the Jewish people wanted gold or oil. They didn't want resources as such to enrich some other empire. Israel was created because the Jewish people believed that they needed some kind of safe haven from persecution. And the thing about settler colonialism is it doesn't end with taking the land, removing the people. Now that there is the stain of guilt of what you've done, you have to make sure that you eliminate the people from existence. You delete them from the history books.
So you can't even see them.
That's right. And there's a campaign of elimination at all levels. Eliminate the people's history. Pretend that they didn't have a history. Appropriating elements of their culture and eliminating and deleting the rest. Controlling the entire narrative that describes what actually happened. Palestinians have had a terrible time trying to basically tell their stories, tell what happened, and we're finally making some headway in that. Finally, the books, it's not easy for Palestinian stories to be heard. I'm kind of appalled that I get to talk and people get to listen to me because I'm from Israel and somehow I have more credibility. I don't like it. Why should my voice be heard better than a Palestinian voice? Because Israel succeeded in creating a world where Palestinians have no credibility. They're getting what they deserve. They're primitive. Their culture is inferior. I grew up in Israel, and Arabic was looked down upon. Anything to do with Arab culture was looked down upon. And by the way, that affected Jews who came from Arab countries as well. Mm. In my family, Jews from Arab countries were seen as inferior. Black, in my family, they called them black. Mm-hmm. So Palestinians are at the bottom of that pecking order altogether. Everything in Arabic, everything to do with Palestinian culture has been treated in Israel as inferior. And again, that was done by all settler colonial and colonial countries about all indigenous people.
At the same time that the Arabs the Palestinians are, well, they call them Arabs. That's another language.
That, yes.
Yeah, they don't call them Palestinians. They are seen as dangerous.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so get rid of them because they are going to kill us.
That's
so
right.
We'll kill them first.
You're absolutely right about that. If there is a murder or a rape in Israel, you probably find it in the United States with the attitude towards black people. It's got to have been a Palestinian first, and then they find out it isn't.
When you say, you know, other countries do this, have always done this, in this country, in America, the right wing, they call the immigrants, they call them illegals, or they call them, of course, criminals and rapists, and we have Trump to thank for that. Whereas the more liberal term would be undocumented people. In Germany, they make a distinction between immigrants and refugees. And it didn't start out like that, but it became a political thing. Migrants, they chose to come. Refugees had no choice. They were fleeing death. If a white person goes and lives in another country, a Brit goes to live in Syria, they would be called an expat. Expat is much more polite. They're not described as a people or a group. We use words like a swarm. They flood,
they're flooding. Hordes in Australia. They call it the hordes.
Or marauders. Refugees. Yeah, marauding foreigners. And Al Jazeera specifically says that to use the word migrant dehumanizes people. It strips them of a voice. It's pejorative. Whereas refugees, because they are being forced to leave rather than choosing to do so, one has compassion for them.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, the thing about colonial is it just doesn't sound like a modern word anymore, does it?
Because we do live in a post-colonial world. I don't think anybody's colonizing anybody except Israel now. At least actively. I mean, there are historical colonies there still. But Israel is an active, ongoing settler colonial project that's not finished yet.
Occupations, in theory, they end. An occupation ends. Settlement does not end until they're all done. When the end comes, then it's finished. But till then, carry on.
I've always said that Israel will not stop until they have all the land without the people.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I said it years and years ago, I still wasn't naming it as settler colonialism. I started a few years ago.
Just to make that distinction one more time, there were a lot of comments to your article, as there always are, on MondoWise. And MondoWise is very interesting, educated, fractious often, but engaged and usually educated readers.
Yeah.
But one of them, a man called Froggy, who said, people don't have the right to take what doesn't belong to them. Individuals who come to a country as bona fide immigrants don't expect to overthrow the existing order so that they can appropriate property, establish their own government, and impose their culture. People who do so are called invaders or occupiers. The Nazis did that when they occupied our village. I guess he or she makes a personal reference there. So this is the idea. You don't get to just go into somebody's house and take it.
That's one of the other interesting things, is that the rules we apply to our own societies internally seem to not apply in the international arena. So if I walked into your home and pushed you into one corner of the house, or pushed you out altogether and said, well, go away, because I'm going to take your house now because I've been homeless and I suffered, and therefore I'm going to just take it, that would not be acceptable. The police will come and remove me and put me in jail. And if I did then also kill members of your family, I would not get away with it in Western society. And yet the international domain, we seem to have a complete jungle.
Mm.
If we applied half of the rules we apply in our own societies to the international arena, everything would look a lot different.
Avigail Abarbanel is talking about how a change in language can influence our understanding of Israel's colonization of Palestinian land. This is Hazel Khan and Tidings on WPKN Radio.
The word occupation in Hebrew is kibush. And kibush in Israel, in Hebrew, doesn't actually mean something temporary. It means permanent. But Israel is quite content for those of us who speak English to use the word occupation, knowing full well what it means to people, that it has an impermanent connotation. Israel can then continue its work that it's doing to finish the settler colonial project while making the rest of us or the rest of the world believe that it's only a matter of time before it ends somehow. In the meantime, they keep doing what they're doing. They're building their colonies or settlements, as you call them, keep trying to push the Palestinians out in every means possible.
Give people an idea of what these colonies look like. They are basically cities, some of them.
They're basically built like fortresses. They're very carefully built on tops of hills. And they're built so that they have, it's almost like medieval castles on tops of hills where they can see everything around them and they can control the lands around them all over the West Bank. And the Palestinians are pushed into ever-decreasing bantustans, they call them, you know, enclaves, smaller and smaller and smaller. It's a normal sight to see some of these rabid, that's about the only new way I can call them, these extremist settlers, so-called colonists, running out down the hill with their guns, invading Palestinian orchards or fields and not allowing Palestinians to do their own harvests or to do their own work, which is why you have monitoring groups that go in there to help with the olive harvest.
To allow the Palestinians to have contiguous land would mean that they might get their own state. So the whole idea of two-state, again, is one of those terms we shouldn't be using.
What you have now is a one state that's an apartheid state with different classes of citizens or different classes of residents in it. And that's it. Israel is already a one state. And even Israelis, admittedly more, if you like, progressive, but they already talk about this. You can read about this in Haaretz as well. There is a one state, effectively. It's just a very bad one. It's just an apartheid one.
Apartheid is another of those words that people don't like to use or don't use. It's going a step too far for many liberals, at least in America. Let's add that
Absolutely.
To the list of language that has to be either included or excluded from now on.
I'm very careful now, the language that I use. The word conflict. Conflict means or implies some kind of a disagreement between two parties.
Two equal parties, yeah.
Equal parties. It implies equality. If you have a conflict in a relationship between a man and a woman, a married couple, the assumption is that there is some kind of an equality between them and they disagree on something. I'm a couple therapist as well. We see that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But where there is, for example, domestic abuse in a relationship, where there's a complete imbalance of power, what we now call coercive control, which is a new evolution of the term domestic violence. The evolution of that language basically expands the definition of what actually is happening in there. We're talking about situations where there might not even be physical violence, but one of the partners has more power over the other and controls and dominates completely in the relationship. I always use this as an analogy to what Israel is talking about with peace talks. How can you have peace talks with the colonized when they have no power? It's a complete fallacy. It's completely wrong on so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have negotiations between two unequal partners. And it's not a conflict. It's something else. It's a power imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, it's a settler-colonial relationship. You've got a colonizer and you've got the indigenous people who are being colonized and on the receiving end of a policy of elimination. And that is not a conflict, and that is not a ground for negotiations.
You say Israel has done a great job of conning, I don't know, the world, I suppose, specifically by using what you call traps. You know, Zionism is another of those words that needs to be linked to settler colonialism. Zionism is and always has been a settler colonial project since the 19th century.
That's right.
Right. Zionism implies territory. You can't have a Jewish nation state without having the territory. So in order to justify itself, Israel has and continues to use these traps. And it's not just the language. What is the argument that Israel makes for doing what it does? When people criticize Israel, what do they say?
I have to go back to my experience of growing up in Israel and being educated on the idea of anti-Semitism. One of the traps I refer to is the anti-Semitism trap that I think Israel is using. So anti-Semitism underpins everything. From within Israel, even the use of the word Zionism by anyone outside of Israel is seen as automatically anti-Semitic or suspected of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is the idea that everybody hates the Jews, always have and always will. That there is something about the world out there that has this uncontrollable and irrational, profound, visceral hatred of Jewish people, and that we have to protect ourselves from that. Israel is seen as the only protection from anti-Semitism. We were brought up to believe that our country, Israel, is the country that protects all Jews all over the world from anti-Semitism and from what might happen if anti-Semitic governments come to power again and Jewish people would have to flee, then they would come to Israel. How you use the anti-Semitism trap, though, is that anybody who dares to criticize Israel is then labeled as anti-Semitic. This is convenient on the inside because then people inside the country don't have to listen to anything. Because any criticism of Israel, aha, you see, they just hate us, and that's what we've always told you. The world always is against us. There are songs in Israel, the world is against us. And so it all just fits perfectly into that lovely spin and trap that Israel has woven. Externally, in a world post-Holocaust, where everybody's so worried about being seen as anti-Semitic because of some psychological guilt about the Holocaust, nobody wants to be seen as anti-Semitic, so everybody's very, very careful what they say. Everybody's walking on eggshells around this whole issue. Even more progressive people, we mustn't talk about Jews, we mustn't talk about Jewish religion, we mustn't criticize Jewish religion, we can only talk about Zionism. And there's this terrible trap. I've had people ask me, do you think I'm anti-Semitic? Am I anti-Semitic and I don't even know it? It seems to me that when people ask questions, ordinary people ask me questions like that, that tells me that Israel's very much succeeded in almost brainwashing people into this. So this is one of the traps, the anti-Semitism trap. If you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. The specialness trap is the other one I'm talking about, and that's a very strong part of Israeli identity and definitely of Jewish identity, is that there is something special about us. We're different. Everything about us is different. We don't just suffer racism, we suffer anti-Semitism. We have a special word for that. Racism isn't normal racism, it's anti-Semitism.
There's also the Holocaust.
It's not a normal genocide, and there's always a Holocaust around the corner that's waiting for us. This is what a lot of Israeli Jews, in fact, the majority actually believe. The Holocaust is not something you're supposed to learn universal lessons from. I mentioned Hannah Arendt in my article. Hannah Arendt, when she went to cover the Eichmann trials in the 1960s, what she came out with is a universal lesson from the Holocaust. She said, we really have to learn about this because this is about a crime against humanity. And she was given a very hard time by Israel because how dare she generalize from the Holocaust? The Holocaust is unique. Mm-hmm. And I was always taught the Holocaust was a unique genocide. It wasn't a normal genocide. There's something very, very special about it. The way the Jews were targeted was not the same as any other people. Everything is special. Our suffering also is special. So in other words, the Jews suffer and have suffered more than any other people on the planet. And I'm not exaggerating when I'm saying it. That's what you're being taught, that our suffering was greater than anyone's. So of course, if the Palestinians suffer, it pales by comparison. You can't compare that. Whatever we're doing to them can't possibly even compare with what was done to us. This is what you would hear in Israel a lot.
Also, and correct me if I'm wrong here, so special is the Holocaust that the word Shoah applies only to the Jewish part of the Holocaust. Am I right?
Absolutely.
I mean, I haven't realized that when they say Shoah, they don't include all the other people who were exterminated by the Nazis.
Oh, no, 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 no. Only the Jews. Shoah means devastation in Hebrew, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. It's a very unique word. It's a word that was created and, if you like, appropriated for this particular HaShoah. It's referred to in Hebrew as the Shoah. The Shoah, not just any Shoah. So, and the same with the Holocaust. It might be a little bit petty of me, but whenever I use the word Holocaust in my writing, I don't capitalize the age.
Yeah, nor do I.
I'm just so annoyed about this. Going back to the idea of the specialness here, if you go back to Israeli settler colonialism, how Israel is confusing everybody is by saying this isn't just settler colonialism. They don't even talk like that, but say it's something special. It's different. We're different. Everything about us is different. Everything we do is different. Our enemies are different. Mm. It's a trap you can't get out of.
Israel has set up a multi-tiered apartheid structure, just things like the roads.
For Jews only.
For Jews only. But anyway, so Israel's done this job. They've set up this multi-tiered apartheid structure and the traps of the Holocaust, the specialness, the anti-Semitism, with the objective of erasing Palestinian culture, which is actually another way of disappearing people, as they did, for instance, in Argentina. So then how does change actually happen? I mean, you're not doing this in order to express yourself.
I speak as a guilty woman. I speak as a woman who served in the Israeli army and feels guilty about my collusion with Israel for as long as it lasted. I feel guilty for the fact that it took me 10 years at least after I left Israel to wake up. And even then, I was still a Zionist without even knowing I was a Zionist. And I speak as a human being who is feeling terrible about the fate of other human beings who don't deserve to be treated like that. I feel the same way about anyone anywhere, but this is more personal to me because it was the country I grew up in, and I was born to a Jewish family, and I was given from a very young age the idea that my whole existence was supposed to be about the survival of the Jewish people, and I rebelled against it. And I thought, no, my job in life is to be who I am and use whatever gifts I might have for the benefit of everybody, not just my own people. It's a very chauvinistic, cultish kind of people. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in, I see myself as a cult survivor, if I'm really honest about it. But I also wanted to say, when we talked about those traps and language and everything Israel is doing, it's actually the acts of the desperate, if you like, the acts of the guilty. I mean, you wouldn't need to go to such lengths if you weren't guilty of something, would you? I'm a terrible activist in a way, because I'm just a keyboard activist, as you call it. I've learned from my own profession, by the way, as a psychotherapist, that we each can make a huge difference by simply changing the narrative around us. And how we do that is by simply talking about things in a different way. So saying the unsayable. And at first, it's not comfortable. If you're the one that stands out, settler colonialism, when everybody else talks about occupation and conflict, it's uncomfortable to be marginalized. But very quickly, you give permission, if you like, to other people to speak in the same language. And if you insist and persist, and you keep doing it, and you don't apologize for it, you just speak, and you speak quietly and firmly and reasonably confidently. Eventually, people begin to speak that way as well. Language catches on, just like everything else. How do we learn to say child abuse and not incest? How do we learn to say people with disabilities and not handicapped? How do we learn to say people with learning disabilities and not retarded? Whoever taught us that?
How do we learn to say African-American or Black instead
exactly.
of Negro?
Exactly. So my point is that each one of us has a role to play. And the article was meant for two kind of audiences. It was meant for the general public, all those people who are activists, who are already on the right track, but are still using the wrong language, in my opinion. And it was meant for, hopefully, people who read Mondo might be journalists in mainstream media. I'm really crossing fingers that some of them might be. And these are the people who really need to change their language. Because once you start to write in the New York Times and the Washington Post and Jerusalem Post and the Times, the newspapers here, the Independent and the Guardian, you start to use words
their
like
language.
Settler colonialism, you start to contest the words like peace talks, and you start to show the empty rhetoric behind it. That when you start to name something for what it is, then other people follow.
Mm.
You know, language gives us an enormous amount of power, and if we just speak properly and say what needs to be said, then gradually other people follow.
That's a very optimistic and encouraging point of view.
I think it's an empowering point of view, and I've seen it happen in my lifetime in different areas, in different domains. It's not always easy, but if we insist and we do that respectfully, but honestly and firmly, I think people begin to listen. The more we say things, the more we say the unsayable, it becomes sayable.
Right, and so, as I say, that's a very optimistic, encouraging, positive point of view. Probably is a good place to end our conversation. Thank you very much, Avigail Ababonel, and we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, Hazel.
Thank you.
You heard Avigail Ababonel talking about how a change in language can influence our understanding of Israel's colonization of Palestinian land. Avigail Ababonel's article, The Palestine-Israel Language Trap, was published in MondoWeiss.net in August. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. All Tidings programs are produced by Tony Ernst and archived as podcasts on hazelkahn.com.